And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on February 18th, 2016. I want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, all that information you're going to need to take action. Let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, February 20th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, we should be getting rain in the next couple of days, so we will be back to continue out French broom pulling at Quail Hollow Ranch. After many years of follow-up, our efforts are surely paying off. Our work sites look very good. And now we have a little help from an interesting insect. See you there. How to get to Quail Hollow Ranch? Take Graham Hill Road north out of Santa Cruz and come down into Felton. Turn right at the first light on East Cyane Road. Go 2 miles up and turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is on the right, about a half a mile up. You'll meet the group in the gravel parking lot on the left-hand side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. Saturday looks like a sunny day, but if it gets particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided, but do bring your gloves and your water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You can email her at redwdrn@packbell.net. That's redwdrn@packbell.net. And be sure to visit their website, www.cruzcnps.org. And over in the East Bay, there's also a restoration. The Alameda Creek Volunteer Restoration Day is happening in Niles, California, February 20th from 10 a.m. to noon. Join us for the upcoming workday at our adopted restoration site along Alameda Creek in Niles on Saturday, February 20th from 10 a.m. to noon. We'll plant more native trees and shrubs, weed, and maintain areas that have been planted by previous volunteers and pick up trash along the creek. A restoration work at this site will help to stabilize soils and stream banks, provide cooling shade, filter pollutants, and improve food and shelter for wildlife. Come learn about the creek and the natural community it supports. We'll meet at the Niles Staging Area parking lot and walk a few hundred yards upstream to our adopted site. Wear work clothes, including long pants and sturdy shoes that can get dirty. A long-sleeve shirt and hat are recommended. We'll provide gloves, waste bags, litter grabbers, water, and a snack. Please bring your own reusable water bottle to fill. If they have heavy rain, which ain't going to happen, it'll cancel. You need to RSVP to ralph@alamedacreek.org. That's ralph@alamedacreek.org. And you can visit their webpage, www.alamedacreek.org. And a recent avian disease outbreak prompts the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to ask the public's help in preventing and reporting bird deaths from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Since mid-December, a fatal disease outbreak has killed increased numbers of pine siskins, a small songbird that inhabits California's forested areas. Scientists from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife believe that infected bird feeders and bird baths are partially responsible for the spread of the disease. These outbreaks have primarily been reported along the central and south coasts, as well as near Redding. CDFW has received 138 reports since early December, representing a minimum of 300 known dead birds. Scientists estimate the actual number to be more than 1,000. CDFW's Wildlife Investigations Laboratory has evaluated carcasses from several locations and determined the cause of mortality to be salmonellosis, a disease caused by Salmonella bacteria. Birds become infected with Salmonella bacteria when they ingest food or water, or come into contact with objects including bird feeders, perches, and soil contaminated with feces from infected birds. Sick birds often appear weak, have labored breathing, and may sit for prolonged periods of time with fluffed or ruffled feathers. Salmonellosis is highly fatal to pine siskins, with most birds dying within 24 hours after they're infected. The two most important things that the public can do to help prevent bird deaths, explained CDFW senior environmental scientist Krista Rogers, an avian disease specialist. First, they can remove all artificial sources of food and water, such as bird feeders, bird baths, and fountains. Secondly, they can report bird deaths to CDFW, particularly when large numbers of birds are found in an area. This information helps us to better monitor disease outbreaks so we can take appropriate action. Bird deaths may be reported to CDFW's Wildlife Investigations Lab to help determine the locations and numbers of birds affected during the salmonellosis outbreak. Outbreaks of salmonellosis in pine siskins appear periodically in some years, with the most recent outbreak occurring in the winter of 2015. The majority of the salmonellosis reports we receive are from locations with backyard bird feeders, said Rogers. These devices may aid in disease transmission between pine siskins and possibly other bird species by bringing birds into closer contact that would occur normally. If sick birds are observed, please contact a local wildlife rehabilitation center for advice. A list of CDFW licensed centers can be viewed at www.dfg.ca.gov/wildlife/wil/rehab/facilities.html. For more information, go to www.wildlife.ca.gov. And Japanese whalers violate the verdict of the International Court of Justice in this press release from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society of Australia. In the vastness of the Southern Ocean, the Japanese whaling fleet has likely been able to illegally slaughter their reduced quota of 333 minke whales. Because of the expanded area of operations and the fact that they are targeting only a third of their usual quota, the Japanese whalers were able to get away with violating the verdict of the International Court of Justice that Japanese whaling operations in the Southern Ocean should be shut down. Sea Shepherd Global had expected that the signatory nations to the United Nations, and especially New Zealand and Australia, would uphold the verdict of the International Court of Justice. They did not. Failing that, Sea Shepherd Global expected that the New Zealand or Australian governments could at least provide Sea Shepherd Global with the coordinates of the Japanese fleet to enable Sea Shepherd Global to gather evidence of this continued illegal activity. They did not. It was especially imperative that such evidence be collected this year to stop these illegal Japanese whaling activities. Sea Shepherd Australia asked both the Australian and New Zealand governments for the coordinates in order to help them do the job that New Zealand and Australia refused to do. Documentation of Japan's continued violations of conservation law and continued contempt for Australian federal court was Sea Shepherd Global's goal for this season. We need evidence of Japan's blatant disregard for the authority of the International Court of Justice, said Captain Alex Cornelison, CEO of Sea Shepherd Global. The collection of such evidence is absolutely crucial to stopping Japan's ongoing illegal slaughter of the whales. We are very disappointed with the Australian and New Zealand governments, said Sea Shepherd Australia Director Jeff Hansen. They initiated a court case against Japan for illegal whaling, and they won the case. Japan ignored the case, and in response, both Australia and New Zealand have simply turned their backs and walked away, seemingly content to allow Japanese crimes against the whales and humanity to continue. It is a shameful lack of response. Sea Shepherd Global's flagship, the Steve Irwin, will continue efforts this season to oppose other illegal activities in the sea where crime reigns unopposed by governments and where poaching is a profitable enterprise by criminal operations that believe themselves to be above the law. For further information, visit the website www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And killer whales risk extinction off of Europe from banned chemicals in this story written by Alistair Doyle with editing by Tom Hennigan, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Killer whales are at risk of extinction off industrialized regions of Europe from poisonous chemicals banned decades ago that are still leaching into the oceans, scientists said. The study, which took samples from 1,000 killer whales, dolphins, and porpoises, urged tougher rules for the disposal of toxic man-made PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls that were used in paints, electrical equipment, and construction until the 1980s. It's really looking bleak. We think there is a very high extinction risk for killer whales as a species in industrialized region of Europe, lead author Paul Jepson of the Zoological Society of London told a telephone news conference. The study by scientists in Spain, Ireland, Portugal, Slovenia, and Britain said concentrations of PCBs in the blubber of killer whales off of Europe, as well as in striped dolphins and bottlenose dolphins, were among the highest recorded worldwide. Levels were lower in harbor porpoises, the fourth species covered in the study, in the scientific journal Scientific Reports. Washed into rivers from unsealed storage sites, PCBs contaminate the seabed where they are eaten by creatures such as mussels or crabs that in turn get consumed by fish that are food for long-lived predators such as killer whales and dolphins. PCBs lodge in fat and build up in the blubber of marine mammals. Killer whales, which are black and white, grow to 33 feet long and can live up to 100 years. PCBs can also be passed on to the young through their mother's milk. Killer whales thrive in many parts of the world, from the Arctic to Antarctica, that are further away from sources of pollution. Without such stronger restrictions, PCBs will continue to drive population declines or suppress population recovery in Europe for many decades to come, the experts wrote. Levels of PCBs in killer whales off of the United States are lower than in Europe, perhaps because Washington banned PCBs in 1979, while Europe lagged, banning them in countries bordering the Mediterranean only in 1987. The study sampled killer whale populations off the Strait of Gibraltar in Spain's Canary Islands, Britain, and Ireland. Previous European populations have vanished from industrial regions in the North Sea to the Mediterranean. And in Rwanda, gorilla youngsters have been seen dismantling poachers' traps in this story from the National Geographic as found on the Earth First Newswire. Just days after a poacher's snare had killed one of their own, two young mountain gorillas worked together to find and destroy traps in their Rwandan forest home, according to conservationists on the scene. This is absolutely the first time we've seen juveniles doing that. I don't know of any other reports of the world of juveniles destroying snares, said Veronica Vecellio, gorilla program coordinator at the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund's Karasoke Research Center, located in the reserve where the event took place. We are the largest database and observer of wild gorillas, so I would be very surprised if someone else had seen that, Vecellio added. Bushmeat hunters set thousands of rope and branch snares in Rwanda's Volcanoes National Park, where the mountain gorillas live. The traps are intended for antelope and other species, but sometimes capture the apes. The adults are generally strong enough to free themselves from the traps, but the youngsters always aren't so lucky. Just last week, an ensnared infant named Ninguino, found too late by workers from Karasoke, died of snare-related wounds. Her shoulder had been dislocated during escape attempts, and gangrene had set in after the ropes cut deep into her legs. The hunters, Vecchiello said, seemed to have no interest in the gorillas. Even smaller apes, which would be relatively easy to carry away for sale, are left behind to die. Poachers build the snares by tying a noose to a branch or a bamboo stalk, Vecchiello explained. Using the rope, they pull the branch downward, bending it. Then they use a bent stick or a rock to hold the noose to the ground, keeping the branch tensed. A sprinkling of vegetation camouflage the noose. When an animal budges the stick or rock, the branch springs upward, closing the noose around the prey. If the creature is light enough, it can actually be hoisted off the ground. Everyday trackers from Karasoke comb the forest for snares, dismantling them to protect the endangered mountain gorillas, which the International Fund for Nature says face a very high risk of extinction in the wild. Recently, a tracker, John Ngabaiche, spotted a trap very close to the Kayuma gorilla clan. He moved in to deactivate the snare, but a silverback named Vuba grunted, cautioning Ngabaiche to stay away. Suddenly, two juveniles, Rowima a male and Dakori a female, both about 4 years old, ran towards the trap. As Ngabaiche and a few tourists watched, Rowima jumped on the tree branch and broke it while Dakori freed the noose. The pair then spied another snare nearby, one the tracker himself had missed, and raced for it. Joining a third gorilla, a teenager named Totero, Rowena and Ducori destroy that trap as well. The speed at which everything happened makes Vecchiello, the gorilla program coordinator, think this wasn't the first time the young gorillas had outsmarted the trappers. They were very confident, she said. They saw what they had to do, they did it, and then they left. Silverbacks in the Kuriyama group have occasionally been caught in snares, so Vecchiello thinks the juveniles would have known the traps are dangerous. That's why they destroyed them, Vecchiello said. Despite the unprecedented nature of the event, Vecchiello said she wasn't surprised by the reports, but she said, I'm always amazed and very proud when we can confirm that they are smart. Veterinarian Mike Cranfield, executive director of the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, also said he wasn't shocked by the news. Chimpanzees are always quoted as being tool users, I think, but when the situation provides itself, gorillas can be quite ingenious, he said. Cranfield speculated that the gorillas may have learned how to destroy the traps by watching Karasoki Center trackers. If we could get more of them doing it, it would be great, he joked. Karasoki's Vecchiello said, she actively instructing the apes would be against the center's ethos. We can't teach them, she said. We try as much as we can do not to interfere with the gorillas. We don't want to affect their natural behavior. And you can find more information at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. Mali's elephants, one of just two remaining desert herds in the world, will be gone in 3 years unless the government does more to protect them, a conservation group said recently. Poachers have taken advantage of the chaos from a growing Islamist insurgency and other unrest in the lawless north to step up ivory trafficking, a trade the United Nations says funds militants. 16 elephants have been killed so far this month, adding to more than 80 slaughtered in 2015, said Susan Canny, director of Mali Elephant Project for the Wild Foundation. We have 50 rangers waiting to be deployed, but they are held up waiting for official approval and firearms from the government, she told Reuters. Mali is standing by while the elephants are being slaughtered. If we continue at this rate, they will be all gone in 3 years. The last aerial census in 2007 showed 350 animals. The West African country's government could not be immediately reached for comment. The army has deployed some forces to the Gourma region in recent weeks to boost surveillance. Malian tusks are thought to be sold in the black market for up to 3 million francs, about $5,000, according to Canny. The African deserts and savannas stretching between the Gulf of Guinea and the Nile Basin once held tens of thousands of elephants, but poaching and loss of habitat has dramatically cut their numbers. Most now live in small, scattered groups. Namibia is home to the world's only other known desert herd. Separately, police in Gabon this week arrested 3 men on suspicion of ivory trafficking after a search that lasted for weeks, the Conservation Justice Campaign group said. 3 Gabonese men were caught in Chilibanga with 43 kilos, about 95 pounds of ivory, it added. Last month, Gabon seized around 200 kilograms, around 500 pounds of ivory, in what may have been its largest catch ever. How to trap elephant poachers with their own technology, in this story by Drazen Horjic. Additional reporting by Fakumba M. Wanakilala. Editing by Sarah Ledsworth, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. One day last October, agents from a crack Tanzanian crime unit raced past Dar es Salaam's Palm Beach Hotel in pursuit of the suspected leader of a global elephant poaching ring. The chase was a result of new breakthroughs in Tanzania's fight against an increasingly rapacious poaching trade, which has felled 60% of the country's elephant population in just the past 5 years. The agent's target that day was Yang Fenglan, a 66-year-old Chinese national dubbed the Ivory Queen. She is accused of running a smuggling empire stretching from the game parks of Tanzania to the clandestine ivory markets of Asia. Her arrest was the culmination of more than a year's work and relied in large part on the novel use of old crime-fighting methods at Tanzania's National and Transnational Serious Crimes Investigation Unit. Helped by a $1.5 million donation from an American philanthropist, the Serious Crime Squad has started to tackle poaching using the lessons it learned from hunting Al-Qaeda in the years after the group bombed 2 U.S. embassies in East Africa in 1998. A Tanzanian court in October charged Yang with heading a criminal network responsible for smuggling 706 pieces of ivory worth $5.5 billion Tanzanian shillings, that's about $2.5 million U.S., between 2000 and 2014. Prosecutors say Yang organized, managed, and financed the criminal racket in ivory totaling 1.9 tons. Yang, currently in jail, could not be reached for comment, but her lawyer, Nahimia Mbokoko, says she is innocent of all charges. The new techniques follow work done in neighboring Kenya, where poaching rates have nosedived. In both countries, the police have started concentrating on the poachers' own technology, their guns and phones, and using it against them. By combining that with old-fashioned detective work, they have captured more suspects. From just one arrest, you can open up the syndicate and go up the ladder from grassroots to brokers to dealers to transporters, all the way up to the international traffickers, said one agent from the squad. The history of a suspect's gun, the phone calls he or she makes, and the money they move create a trail of evidence. Tanzania has been hit hard by a global spike in poaching over the past decade. Its elephant population has dropped to about 43,000 in 2014 from 109,000 just in 2009. Interpol has said a significant portion of ivory reaching international markets originated from elephant herds in Tanzania. The region has also become a vital part of the African smack track, a smuggling route for Afghan heroin headed for Europe. Western diplomats see a growing overlap between ivory smugglers and narcotics traffickers. They are all interlinked. Drug traffickers in East Africa use the same people that weapons smugglers use and that the ivory smugglers use, said one Nairobi-based agent from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. The capture of Yang Fang Yang started with a tip-off in 2014, and a baobab studded hills of the Ruhuahurunga ecosystem, where the elephant population plummeted from 20,000 to 8,000 between 2013 and 2014. Local informants pointed crime squad agents toward Manasi Philemon, a suspected Tanzanian ivory dealer who was barely literate but who could mysteriously speak Chinese. Under interrogations, Philemon fingered Yang, who police believe taught him Mandarin. Manasi worked so closely with this woman for a long time, said the agent. Yang's ties to Tanzania spanned four decades. She studied Swahili at the Chinese University and moved to the country in the 1970s to work as a translator for Chinese engineers building a railway line to Zambia, according to court documents, police sources, and an interview she conducted with the China Daily newspaper. In the 1990s, she returned to Tanzania and opened a popular Chinese restaurant in Dar es Salaam. She was also Secretary General of the Tanzania China-Africa Business Council. After Philemon's tip-off, she also became the NTSCUI's top target. But the anti-poaching team had problems. Many of the agents were trained by Western spy agencies in the wake of the U.S. embassy bombings in Tanzania, and their main task was to counter the threat from homegrown Islamists. There was not enough cash or manpower to act against poaching, and that did not operate countrywide. At this point, the nonprofit PAMS Foundation got involved. Its leader, Wayne Lauder, sought help from David Bonderman, an American billionaire who made a fortune in private equity and had the Rolling Stones play at his 60th birthday bash. Bonderman's Wildcat Foundation donated about $1.5 million, and the NTSCUI anti-poaching team began recruiting trusted people from the Tanzania Intelligence and Security Service, Police, Army, Immigration, Judiciary, and the National Wildlife Service. I believe the NTSCUI provides a model of how serious enforcement against wildlife poaching and trafficking can be accomplished if a country's leadership has the political will to make it happen, said Wildcat founder director Roger Slickensides. By the time of Yang's arrest, about six people were working on the anti-poaching team out of 200 or so NTSCUI agents. They set about building networks of informants and built a strategy. They called it Follow the Gun, Save the Elephant. Immediately after a suspect was captured, the agents focus on the suspect's weapon. Tracing how the poacher obtained that gun leads to a person one level above in the syndicate and points in the direction of a team. Philemon helped here. He gave us the cream of the dealers, said the agent. It was just as they began building a case against Yang, she vanished. In June 2014, a Tanzanian court charged Philemon with trafficking ivory, and Yang fled to Uganda, according to sources familiar with the case. Philemon has not entered a plea and cannot be reached for comment. More than a year later, her phone revealed where she was. NTSCUI is able to pull up poachers' phone numbers and call history, said one security expert who works closely with the squad. Computer software is used to delineate links between on-the-ground poachers, dealers, and transnational criminal gangs. A server flags to NTSCUI mobile phone numbers when they become active, but does not record the calls. The machine is on 24 hours a day, said an expert. Mobile phones also help agents follow the money. Many Africans send and receive money via their phones. That means agents who monitor phone calls can also track payments, helping to build up a picture of who is involved. The mobile phones technology has come in very handy, said Robert Muasaya, head of security for Kenya's Wildlife Service. If we catch a poacher, we are able to analyze his phone and analyze the content, know whether this phone had appeared somewhere else, and we are able to connect the dots. It was thanks to Yang's phone that about a year after she had left for Uganda, Tanzanian agents discovered she was back in Dar es Salaam. But the unit still had a major problem, said the agent. We had no photographs of her. Again, her mobile phone helped them to track her to a house in the center of the city. They laid a trap and waited. At dusk fell 7 hours later, Yang burst out of the house, dashed for her car, and sped off. The agents followed, zigzagging through heavy traffic, fearing they would lose her. They hit her car to bring it to a halt. Yang was shocked by the agent's audacity, but the NTSCUI agent said she came out of the car very angry. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz. FRSC broadcasts at 101.3 FM and can be found streaming live at www.freakradio.org. And you can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. That's Friday at 3, right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you're in the Moscow, Idaho area, listen to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, at 90.3 FM at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update can also be heard at Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, in Boston, Massachusetts, also on 90.3 FM, between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. An internet radio station called the Grateful Dread Public Radio airs the Earth First Update Sunday at 2 a.m. Their URL is www.gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org. You can also find them at tunein.com and spotify.com. And you can listen to or download the Earth First Update at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And I'd like to ask you to talk to your local nonprofit community radio station. Tell them they can air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download. The Earth First Update is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz and is a production of Earth First Radio. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.